from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow comes the long-awaited final report from the 9/11 Commission. It's expected to say that in the battle against terrorism, America needs a new intelligence czar to oversee all U.S. intelligence operations. But our guest tonight says the problem the country faces is far bigger and far worse than leaders in Washington are willing to acknowledge. America's political elite refuses to accept the obvious, he says, that the threat of a global Islamic insurgency has not been honestly described to the American people, that Afghanistan is being lost, that war with Iraq is just what Osama bin Laden wanted, that terrorists will attack again and massively on American soil, that this war may go on into our children's generation. Our guest tonight isn't just another pundit. He is not an academic observer. His voice comes from deep within the U.S. intelligence community. He's a respected senior officer at the CIA who has focused for 17 years on terrorism and militant Islam. And he's the anonymous author of a new book that is the talk of Washington. Tonight on Point, a scathing insider's critique of the war on terror. We spoke with our guest earlier today, so can't take your calls tonight, but you can continue this conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. Joining me now from Washington is Anonymous, author of the new book, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. Good evening and welcome to On Point.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's terrific to have you. We're told we can call you Mike, but if we could, I'd like to just deal with this Anonymous business right off the top here and ask why. We're told we can call you Mike, but you're called in the Washington Post, the most public anonymous man in Washington or in history. The Boston Phoenix and now many outlets around the world have gone right ahead and identified you as Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. It's all out there. It's all over the web. It's in the press. Why are you signing this book anonymous?
It was a requirement for publication by my employer, Tom. I requested to use my true name, and they denied that. They thought it was best that I identify neither myself nor my employer.
It is very unusual for a serving CIA officer at your level to come forward with such a thoroughgoing and scathing critique of American policy. Why have you done it?
Primarily because I don't think that either our policymakers or the American people realize what kind of a problem we've tied into with Osama bin Laden and what he symbolizes and personifies in terms of an enemy.
And give us a sense of your own background to the extent you can to help us judge what you would know, the depth of your experience and awareness of bin Laden and Islamic terrorists.
Well, I've worked in the U.S. intelligence community for almost 23 years. I have worked almost all of that, about 18 years on Islamic militancy on South Asia, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and on terrorism and narcotics in the Middle East.
And are you denying that you headed from 96 to 99 the CIA's special Osama bin Laden task force?
No, I'm not denying nor confirming that, sir.
But that, of course, is the very public report. So give us your critique, Mike. At heart, what is wrong? There are a million things here, but for, top level, what's wrong with the U.S., quote-unquote, war on terror?
It's a lack, I think, Tom, of the recognition of our enemy. We continue to identify Osama bin Laden, the people who follow him or sympathize with him as, for example, the former DCI, the director of Central Intelligence, called them the lunatic fringe of the lunatic fringe of the Muslim world. And it's the argument that they're terrorists and there are very few of them. And, you know, both of the last presidents, Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush, have said that this really has nothing to do with Islam, that there's no religious motivation here, that it's just more or less criminality and gangsterism. And those things aren't true. And until you come to grips with that fact, it's very hard. It's going to be very hard for America to make progress against this enemy. The second point I would make in this area is that our leaders continue to say that Bin Laden is attacking us because of our way of life, because of our democracy and our liberties and our free political system and free speech. And while Bin Laden and his like don't like those things, don't admire those, they're certainly not the cause of the war. The war is based primarily by a limited number of U.S. policies toward the Islamic world that Bin Laden has identified as an attack on Islam and are being perceived by increasing numbers of Muslims as just such an attack.
So you're saying this is not a fight over who we are or American values, but rather a specific U.S. policies, and we'll look at those in a moment. More importantly, or perhaps even before that, you say this is not a war with terrorism. It's a plain old war.
It is, sir. It is America's clandestine service has scored spectacular successes in the last decade against Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization. Had it been a terrorist organization of the type we've been fighting for the better part of two decades, it would have been destroyed several times over. And yet it remains a vibrant, dangerous organization, one which the DCI and the FBI director have just recently said probably is capable of detonating a weapon of mass destruction inside the United States. So this is a much bigger enemy than a terrorist group. A terrorist group is at worst a lethal nuisance. The people who die from attacks by Hezbollah or Abu Nidal, that's a tragedy, but it doesn't affect national security. Bin Laden's organization, al-Qaeda, on the other hand, is a direct threat to the United States in terms of national security.
And you say, we'll look at the nature of that threat, but for beginners, for starters, you say the West is losing the war on terror. Make that case.
The case, sir, is we're clearly not winning in Iraq, for example, in the strictest military terms. Afghanistan, the insurgency in Afghanistan is coming back to life. It's much more intense. The tempo of it is increasing over the past 6 to 8 months. You can see on your television every day the growing insurgency in Iraq, the number of fighters that are coming from all over the Islamic world to attack the United States troops and those of its coalition partners. We've seen an unprecedented number of attacks by al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-related people against European targets, for example. The list goes on and on, and then our leaders keep saying the threat is current and dangerous inside the United States. It's hard to see from a military sense how we're making much progress against this target. And in terms of support for bin Laden, he clearly is really the only Islamic leader in the entire world who Muslims look up to. There is just such a paucity of leadership in the Muslim world that bin Laden, by default and by his actions, has become probably the single most important leader in all of the Islamic world today. Just anecdotally, there's more defense around the White House today, for example, than there was during World War II when FDR was fighting two wars against two fascist empires. Mm. The evidence is almost overwhelming if you take a step back and look at it.
But despite occasional comments to the contrary, George Tenet before Congress early this year, we often hear noises from the administration saying, we are winning this war, we've got to stay on the path we're on, it's the path to victory, we've taken the war to the terrorists, we're winning.
Well, yes, sir, they do say that, and we've heard that pretty consistently over the last dozen years, and it's just frankly not true. We're engaged in more places now than we were before, that's true, but just being there doesn't mean we're winning. As I said, Iraq is hardly stable. We see our ally in Saudi Arabia becoming less stable as each month goes by. We have the war in Afghanistan. It's hard for me, and I'm just one person, of course, but it's hard for me to see progress to any extent at all.
Why are you taking this argument, and it's a long and detailed and provocative and hair-raising argument, I have to say. It's quite a compelling book. Why are you bringing this to the American public rather than up the chain of command inside the CIA where you're working rather than to the directly to the leadership in Washington?
The leadership has not been particularly eager to hear what I've had to say in the past 5 or 6 years. And so I still felt it incumbent on me as a civil servant to try to bring what I thought to the American people. After all, they're the ones that paid for my career over the past 20-plus years, and it's been a marvelous career from my perspective. In the most selfish level, I wrote it to try to protect my children. We have two young children, two older daughters, and three granddaughters, and they're the ones that are going to have to fight this war at the other end if we don't get on the stick and begin to become more effective.
You put this all under the umbrella of imperial hubris. Why do you tie it back to such a grand idea, overweening pride and all that?
Well, I've written two books now on this subject, and what I wanted to demonstrate was that there's no mystery about this target, this enemy, that it's not, as they say, rocket science to understand what's going on. Both of my books are based entirely on materials available in the media, whether newspapers or journals or speeches by bin Laden. The point I wanted to make was you have to be willfully blind not to see the problem in all its dimensions.
And why would the United States, with so much at stake, be willfully blind?
We're pretty handicapped, sir, I think, as you know, in terms of frank political discussion. It's very hard, at least within the intelligence community, to argue about the role of religion, for example, in a war. The possibility that perhaps our society is in America is better, more valuable than other societies overseas, and therefore worth protecting. The political correctness of the last decade and more, especially under Mr. Tenet within the intelligence community, has been a stultifying handicap on frank analytic debate.
And as a result, what are the policy consequences?
The policy consequences are we continue to say the same thing over the past 12 years, that this has nothing to do with religion, for example, that these people are terrorists, for example, that only a minute portion of the Islamic world feels the way bin Laden feels against about U.S. policies. It's a process by which we delude ourselves into believing that this is somehow an aberrant or a deviant group of people rather than a group that's increasingly expressing the mainstream opinion of the Islamic world vis-a-vis the United States. Whether or not they support bin Laden's military actions is another question entirely. But the view of the Muslim world increasingly is the view of bin Laden vis-a-vis our policies and their impact.
But how different is what the government has been saying over this last decade from what you're saying? When you get specific on this, you say Islam is at war with America, but then under the headline you say some of Islam is waging war on the United States and more is edging closer to that status. Is that so different from what George Bush says?
I think it is, because I try to back it up without sounding Cassandra-like in all occasions. The polling is really startling in terms of the recent polls some very reputable companies have conducted in the Islamic world, polls that show populations in Muslim countries opposing our policies by 80% to 90%, and at the same time supporting but approving of the basic decency, equality, chances for social mobility within our society. So the poll results, and it's only recently we've had this kind of scientific polling evidence, clearly shows that bin Laden would find very little support for a war on the United States against our society, against our way of life, against our political system. But there's an immense pool of dissatisfaction, hatred even, for U.S. policy out there, which bin Laden can draw on and count on over the next decade or more.
We're going to come back and look at the details of that. I'm talking tonight with the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He is a senior CIA official, focused for 17 years on terror and militant Islam, reported to be the head of the Osama bin Laden unit until 1999. He's called, at the top of this book, anonymous. We'll be right back with him. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the author of the new book, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. The author is an unusual man, a senior CIA officer listed here only as anonymous in the credits for this book, but widely described in the press, and he doesn't deny it, as the man who, from 1996 to 1999, was head of the Osama bin Laden unit within the CIA and a 17-year tracker within the Central Intelligence Agency of militant Islam and terrorism. He joins me tonight from Washington. It is a scathing critique, top to bottom, of Washington's response to a terrorist threat that he describes as more than a terrorist threat. He goes by Mike, and he's been widely reported to be Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA bin Laden unit. Mike, take us into the policy that you say is drawing the fire of Osama bin Laden and increasing and an increasing portion of the Islamic world. You say it's not who we are, as it's often been portrayed. It's not American values. It's specific American policies. Name them.
Well, there's six policies which bin Laden has focused on consistently in his public statements since 1996. One is our presence on the Arabian Peninsula, which is, as you know, the most holy place in Islam. The second is our support for what he terms apostate and tyrannical Muslim regimes from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, including the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Kuwaitis. He also focuses on our ability to maintain oil prices at a level acceptable to the Western consumer, thereby denying increased revenue to the Muslim world. Of course, his dislike for our unqualified support for Israel in all circumstances and policies. The fifth would be our support for other governments that, according to his creed, oppress Muslims: the Hindus, the Indians in Kashmir, the Russians in Chechnya, the Chinese in Western China. And the final one is our military presence in other areas of the Muslim world, such as Yemen, now Iraq. So those are the six, if you will, his foreign policy issues. And as I said earlier, the polls show that those are widely viewed in the Islamic world as being anti-Muslim or anti-Islamic.
If the conflict, then, at least from Osama bin Laden's view, by your analysis, is over these policy issues, why do you portray this as almost a religious war, a war between Islam and the West?
Well, because that's the way he portrays it. That's the way it's perceived, that these policies are designed to eliminate Muslims. They're aimed at Muslim countries, at Muslim resources, at among the most important things, Muslim sanctities. We and our allies now occupy, at least in the view of bin Laden, the three most holy places in Islam: the Arabian Peninsula, the Iraq, which is the second holiest place in Islam, and the Israelis hold Jerusalem, which is the third. It's very much in terms of an assault on Islam that bin Laden and others fight, and frankly, the policies he's identified are really his only indispensable ally. As long as those policies remain as they have been over the past 20 to 25 years, they will allow him ample room for growth in terms of both fighters and sympathy and donors and general support.
You know, some of these policies, most of them, are so deeply ingrained in American posture in the world, very hard to change them, not to say impossible, but very hard, given how hard it would be. Maybe the White House has been correct in refusing to bite on this as a religious war, a war with Islam. Wouldn't that just unite all of Islam against the United States if it was framed that way?
Well, that's you know, very much what's happening already. And what I'm concerned with is much less what Muslims think. I only care in the sense that if we understand what they think, we're better able to focus and draft a policy that would defeat them. But the point is, we've backed ourselves in a corner, I think, over the last decade. We have only the military option with which to pursue the defense of the United States. And in the short term, that's probably enough. We're a very powerful country. But over the longer term, there are 1.3 billion Muslims. We have very many constraints on our use of military power, and it's just not going to be enough. But political correctness comes in again here, I think, Tom. Our landscape is just littered with people who suggested that perhaps it's time to be a little less unqualified in our support for Israel, to try to reestablish the position we held, for example, in 1945 as an anti-colonial power, as a liberator.
The landscape is littered, meaning what?
There's lots of people who have tried to raise that issue and been immediately labeled anti-Semite or anti-Israeli. It's almost as if you can't be pro-American without being also equally pro-Israeli. Our Israeli policy clearly needs to be debated.
So in your view, let's put that right out there, what is that policy costing the United States?
Well, one thing it does, the policy of complete support for Israel and the result which we see every day in the West Bank and in Gaza is perceived, at least in the Muslim world, as just our willingness to let the Israelis do whatever they want to do. And our words on this issue of playing the honest broker, of saying we support peace between both sides, is really severely undercut and almost unheard in the Muslim world since the advent of Arabic satellite television. Every day, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, the two major networks broadcasting in the Middle East in Arabic, broadcast live out of the West Bank and Gaza. And as long as the Muslim population of the world from Morocco to the Philippines see on their daily TV Israelis killing Palestinians and Palestinians killing Israelis, but generally the Palestinians getting the worse end of the deal, the perception at least is that the Americans are just letting the Israelis run wild.
So more distance from Israel, or at least even-handedness, you're saying that's a tall order right at the start. What about oil and inexpensive oil? That, too, is kind of a central tenet of American political life.
Yes, it certainly is, sir. You know, it's been a long time, maybe since the oil embargo of the 70s, since we've had any kind of national debate on the issue. And it's probably suicidal for a politician at this point to say, well, maybe we need to move into alternate energy sources, and maybe we need to drill in the Arctic preserve. But that's an issue that, just because they're hard to discuss doesn't mean they shouldn't be discussed. It's very hard to suggest a policy for the future when you can't even talk about the dangers of the policy you're pursuing at the moment. And really, that's the problem we have right now. I think probably it'd be hard to discuss the fact that the United States is supporting tyrannies across the Muslim world. There's no democracies there, and our allies are completely absolute monarchies that are police states ranging from efficient to inefficient. But nonetheless, there's no democracies out there.
But as I read you, when you turn to talk about democracy in the Middle East or Afghanistan, you seem to be very skeptical, saying you describe Afghanistan as a failed war or a half-won war. You tell me, but you're not promoting democracy, the promotion of democracy, as the cutting edge of the U.S. response to these attacks by Al-Qaeda.
No, sir, clearly I'm not. It's very hard to take the United States seriously in terms of promoting democracy when all of our allies in the Middle East are tyrannies. And that's clearly one thing that bin Laden has picked up on and is a view widely shared by the United States, that we talk democracy on the one hand and we support tyranny, whether it's President Mubarak or the al-Sauds in Saudi Arabia on the other hand.
But isn't Afghanistan supposed to be the beginning of the end of that policy?
Well, I don't, I think that's the hope. But the other thing to say about democracy in the Middle East is that two things. First, there's no separation between church and state in Islam. And in a sense, if you're preaching to these people to adopt the secular democratic system such as ours, you're basically saying turn your back on God and make your own laws rather than have the laws that were revealed by your Lord. It's a very culturally abhorrent idea in the Middle East, and it's rather arrogant to assume that somehow we're going to talk them into doing that. The other thing that strikes me about this making of democracies overseas, Tom, is you can forgive policymakers and politicians and senior civil servants if they don't know the history of Saudi Arabia or Islam or Afghanistan, but it's very hard to forgive them for not knowing their own history. Our democracy has been on the building blocks since, pick a date, since 1215 at Runnymede when the barons took some power from the king. Yeah. We're 800 years into building our democratic system, and it's not quite to the stage of perfection yet. I think it's delusionary, if not madness, to think you're going to slip that on some CD-ROMs and send them to Iraq or Afghanistan, and people are going to install the same sort of system over the next 6 months or 6 years.
And here's where the critique gets so interesting. You're not the standard issue critic of the war on terror, of the war in Iraq. You're not pushing to push or build democracies, the kind of traditional American line there. You're not, like the Democrats and critics of the war before it was launched, you're not pushing for coalition building either.
No, sir. If the book has one theme, I think it is to take a cogent, detailed look at where we are in the world and to take some policies that are in the interest of America. It's a very much a nationalist book, I think. I think we pay too much attention to what other people think and what other people want, and we squander our prestige, we squander our resources, and we squander our basic decency by pursuing some of these goals overseas.
And yet George Bush has been perceived as the president who above all, has not cared what others have thought, who has defined himself, at least, by defining America's interests as he sees them and pursuing them come hell or high water, no matter what anyone thinks.
Well, I think there's a difference between what's asserted and what's real. They spend a considerable amount of time, for example, building a coalition which still had 30 or more countries when we went to Iraq. They delayed going into Afghanistan for almost a month, in essence letting the enemy get away while they built support among the Chinese and the Russians and our more traditional allies. My view on this is we have many fewer interests in the world than we now pursue. And if we have an interest that's really a national security threat, which is defined traditionally as a life and death issue, then we really should pursue it off our own hook and not wait around for various and sundry to come to help us.
And that leaves you saying, well, we can't change all these American policies overnight. The tool that we have right now at our disposal is the U.S. military. And as I read through the book, Imperial Hubris, one of your primary directives to the United States is get used to and get good at killing. You're a hawk. What's your prescription here?
No, sir, I'm not really a hawk. What the book argues is that because we are not changing any policies, because our public diplomacy, our protestations of benign intent in the Muslim world are not being listened to, that we've left ourselves with only the military option. And if we intend to defend the United States, we need to use that option more aggressively when we have the opportunity.
So give us your, if you could turn the key on the new policy as outlined by Anonymous, longtime veteran of the CIA, how does it begin? How does the U.S. get tougher and also move toward changing policy at the same time?
Well, it's going to take some political will in this country, sir, to do both things. We consistently, for example, apply the military force with a view toward not offending people by appearing too brutal or too ruthless in our activities. And we're also afraid to death of losing our own people. We missed Osama bin Laden in late 2001 in a place called Tora Bora in Afghanistan simply because we refused to use our own troops to go in there and get him. We hired surrogates who were his longtime allies. what I'm saying is that when you have information, and this is strictly from my own experience in the intelligence world, the quality of the intelligence on Osama bin Laden has been required to be something that approaches the level of evidence that's used in United States courts.
Before what kind of action?
Before action can be taken.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone through now two national commissions, the Shelby Goss Commission and now the 9/11 Commission, and we've heard very powerful senior leaders, whether it was the DCI, two secretaries of state, Mr. Clark from the NSC, go before these committees and say, well, we had a chance to get Osama bin Laden, but the evidence wasn't good enough. Or we might have killed an Arab prince, or we might have hit a mosque with shrapnel and made Muslims mad at us. And it's been astounding to me, and I've participated in both investigations, that none of the congressmen or senators, none of the members of the Cain Commission ever said, Mr. Director, why didn't you err on the side of protecting Americans? Why were you always more concerned with the opinion of the Europeans, the possible loss of an Arab prince of which the world is flush, and or offending Muslims by hitting a mosque with a piece of shrapnel? The dearth of people willing to take a chance to defend America and American citizens is, to me, a stunning situation to find ourselves in.
Even now, when the American death count of troops in Iraq is headed over 900?
Oh, I think so. You know, we don't see that. Those are mostly from attacks on us rather than us attacking them. We're very much a defensive-minded country at the moment, which is entirely out of historical character for us. We never want to go to war, but when we go to war, we generally are very aggressive and get it over as soon as we can. Our mindset on this issue against bin Laden is entirely defensive.
How can you say that with 130,000-plus American troops in Afghanistan and thousands in Iraq and thousands more in Afghanistan, still a defensive posture?
Well, sure. You read the papers about Afghanistan, and we're not going out to beat the bushes to find these guys. We're mostly in garrisons. One of bin Laden's great frustrations, I think, is that it took him the better part of a decade to get our forces on the ground in Afghanistan, and now they're there and they're mostly occupying cities. They're not coming out in the countryside to fight the enemy. But we don't want to lose troops. I think we could be much more aggressive in Iraq also. I think the problem is just our generals have become bureaucrats. I think they blow which way the wind is blowing politically.
And you're saying that ultimately in this battle, progress will be measured by the pace of killing, precise counts that will run to extremely large numbers.
Yes, sir. We're facing an enemy that's talented, experienced, extremely well organized, and doesn't wear uniforms. And as long as we're forced to pursue this war through only the military means, if we're going to defend America, we're going to have to kill a lot more people than we've done so far.
We're talking tonight with the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He goes, for the purposes of authorship of this book, by anonymous. He's been widely identified as Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. We'll be right back with more of our interview. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the author of the new book, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He is a longtime CIA official, a senior CIA official, focused for 17 years on terrorism and militant Islam. He was required by the Central Intelligence Agency to sign this document, this manuscript, this book, anonymous. But he has been widely described as the former chief of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. And it is a very thoroughgoing critique, a tough critique. He says this war is going to go on for a long time and into our children's lives if we don't pursue it more effectively. You say that the United States is essentially losing the war in Afghanistan. The President Bush has described it as a victory. We're on the way to the polls. You say we're losing it in slow motion. How do you see what's happening there?
What we did was, for whatever reason, we were entirely unprepared to attack Afghanistan on the day we were attacked in New York and Washington. I think that's a kind of an undiscussed scandal that after fighting bin Laden for the better part of, what, 6-7 years, the U.S. military was entirely unable to have a response prepared and ready for when we were attacked.
Doesn't it take more than 24 hours to launch an operation to topple a regime, take over a country?
Well, it does when you're not ready. You know, certainly they could have had pre-positioned people. The essence of the problem was we've known for a decade that both al-Qaeda and the Taliban are basically insurgencies that are rooted in the countryside, not in the cities. We weren't ready to hit them on the 11th of September or the 12th or the 13th of September, they were going to be gone. They were back. They would be back in the rural countryside and disappear into villages and mountains where it would be very difficult to dig them out of.
And you're saying they are back now, and the United States is going to be fighting them for a long time, or else withdrawing in essentially defeat, however it's portrayed.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. We'll come down to the choice of either greatly increasing the number of our troops there and also using them very much more aggressively, or we'll find a way to leave with some kind of a reason for leaving that doesn't look too bad.
And what about Iraq? You say we've got to be tougher on all fronts, but yet it was only a few months ago in Fallujah when a high-level decision was made not to go in and destroy Fallujah and the insurgents there, the thought being it would be too terrible a setback in the battle for hearts and minds in the Middle East and around the world. What would you have done with Fallujah?
Tom, we've completely lost that battle of hearts and minds. It's something we shouldn't, in the near term, pay an awful lot of attention to. Something that can't be recouped as long as our policies stay the same. And one of the things that comes across increasingly from the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq is that Osama bin Laden, the insurgents in Iraq, the people that think like them, they've experienced two wars staged by the world's greatest superpower. They look up and they're still alive and they figure, well, we rode this out. We can beat the Americans. They weren't ruthless enough. They weren't brutal enough. In Fallujah, again, the first book I wrote was about seeing the world through our enemy's eyes. And Fallujah was a very important defeat for the United States in the eyes of our enemy. Bin Laden and his supporters view the U.S. Marine Corps as the elite, as the only really part of the U.S. military they're scared of. And had we allowed the Marines to go in and do the job we had asked them to do and finish it, it would have made a very important point in the minds of our enemies. But instead, Mr. Bremer or whoever decided to have the Marines do half the job, lose however many of their own troops in the process, and call them back with the job being unfinished. And we applaud ourselves in the West for our civility and our willingness to talk and negotiate. But in the Islamic mind, in the mind of bin Ladenists, if you will, that was a clear defeat for the Marines. The Marines couldn't take Fallujah is the message that comes across. And again, perception so often is reality. Fallujah comes down in the battle lore of al-Qaeda and the other insurgents as a victory.
You're a senior official in the CIA. This is very strident advice. Flatten Fallujah, never mind hearts and minds. It sounds as though it sets the United States up to indeed take on the entire Islamic world. Are you surprised, giving that kind of advice, that some in American administrations, Bush and Clinton, would back away from the course that you're recommending?
No, I'm not at all surprised. And that's the point I'm making is that it's time to think about Americans and the security of Americans and the safety of American people and, most selfishly, the safety of my children and grandchildren. Whether or not they want to say that it's this kind of war, the fact is staring them in the face. And I'm not – until you recognize a problem, you're never going to defeat it. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but it doesn't take a lot to see that we're not winning this particular set of struggles.
You've been looking at it for a long time. Since 9/11, we haven't had another big terrorist attack in the United States. Many Americans – have returned to old routines and maybe even returning to older frames of mind. You're clearly not able to do that, having tracked bin Laden as long as you have. How do you see the stakes in the conflict that the United States is engaged in right now, whether it wants to be in the conflict or not?
The stakes are that eventually the way we live in the United States will become unrecognizable to us that are to the people that are alive now. We will. Bin Laden has said publicly, and I think we see it to some extent already, that we will terrorize ourselves through continuous warnings and through being worried about attacks in the United States, and we will ourselves constrict our liberties of in terms of movement, in terms of travel, in terms of how the police look at citizens and how citizens look at the police, and how we look at tourists coming from overseas. Even, you know, we have quite a marked change in our lifestyle just trying to travel on aircraft or railroads, trying to get into public buildings, trying to get in to see what the White House looks like. You have to go through multiple concentric rings of defense. This is the kind of reality that America will face over the future if we are not more aggressive in pursuing the enemy and killing him, and at the same time debating on whether it's time to change the nature of some of our policies.
So go out and get very, very tough right now. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, figure out how to change policies in the Middle East quite radically. Tomorrow, the 9/11 Commission is going to deliver its report. Do you expect to see this kind of recommendation reflected there at all?
No, I don't. What I expect to see tomorrow is a kind of tinkering with the structure of the intelligence community. I don't expect to see anybody, any individual fault recognized, although there's a significant number of senior officials who failed in their duties. There'll be very little blame. And I think what they'll do is focus on defensive issues, how many times we could have caught somebody going into the country. They probably won't ask very much of either administration. Why didn't you go after the bad guys more vigorously? And why didn't, as I said earlier, why didn't you err on the side of protecting Americans?
How widespread in the CIA is your perspective?
I can only claim to speak for myself, but the substance of this book and the substance of the first book I wrote were very well received by people who work on the issue on a day-to-day and year-to-year basis. Regarding my superiors or peers, I've never gotten any kind of response from any of them.
And your epilogue is brutal. It says, epilogue, colon, no basis for optimism. Good Lord.
Well, I think that's what I think. That's exactly what I think. There's just, I don't see how you can combat a problem, win a war, unless you realize really what the enemy is up to and what he's about and what motivates him. And as long as we cling to these ideas that they're criminals and we can settle the issue with primarily the use of law enforcement and courts and a very moderate application of military power, I see no reason for hope. I use an epigram there from Lincoln after the Battle of Antietam, where he said, these people just don't realize we're in a bloody war that's going to have to be fought out to the end. And that's about where we are, sir.
Still looking at a bloody war that's going to have to be fought to the end. There is a very contrary view of all that's going on in the so-called War on Terror from the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, widely reported to be head of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. Thanks for joining us tonight. Good to have you.
My pleasure, sir. You're very kind.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's the summer reading season, but according to a recent study by the National Endowment for the Arts, fewer Americans are picking up books of literature than ever before. Fewer than half of all Americans read a novel, short story, poem, or play over the last year. Even if you don't particularly care for books, the civil and cultural consequences of the study are terrifying for a free society, says NEA Chairman Dana Gioia. You cannot delegate a democratic society to a small elite. Oregon resident Susan Nielsen is dangerously close to joining the throngs of Americans who haven't cracked a book in 12 months. In this radio diary, she wonders how she has allowed herself to live a literature-free life.
One of the many good books getting ignored this summer is a yellowed paperback on my nightstand, unread except for the first paragraph. The classic novel by Ray Bradbury begins like this. It was a quiet morning, the town covered over with darkness and at ease in bed. Summer gathered in the weather. The wind had the proper touch. The breathing of the world was long and warm and slow. You had only to rise, lean from your window, and know that this, indeed, was the first real time of freedom and living. This was the first morning of summer. This is the kind of book that can't be read in snatches here and there, so it's not being read at all, just like countless other good books on nightstands and in bookstores across the country. Americans read far fewer novels now than they did 20 years ago, and the decline in book reading is speeding up, according to a survey released earlier this month by the National Endowment for the Arts. The NEA calls this a national crisis. To me, it's just the biggest downside of living in an information-glutted, speed-loving age. We're running out of time for the virtues tucked in the pages of books: imagination, contemplation, and wisdom. Americans now have unprecedented access to bits of information, like 1,000 new acquaintances at a never-ending party. But we have less time for the novels and poetry that used to comfort and enrich, like old friends. It's hard to adjust from the rapid-fire day to the languid pace of a novel. To my horror, I'm suddenly 5 months shy of joining this demographic, people who haven't read a book for pleasure in a year. The statistics about fewer readers are unexpected, given the blockbuster sales of such books as the Harry Potter series and Bill Clinton's memoirs. But the success of a few doorstop-sized books can't compensate for millions of people losing the book-reading habit. Television doesn't seem to be the culprit, the NEA says. Adults watch the same amount of TV now as they did a generation ago, about 3 hours a day on average. Book readers watch almost as much TV as non-readers. But the NEA does mention some other plausible reasons for the drop in book reading. One is internet access at home. The other is September 11th. Only a quarter of households had internet access in 1998. That number nearly doubled 2 years later and keeps rising, coinciding with a drop in book reading. The NEA also speculates that terrorism and war might affect people's reading habits. Americans may spend so much time checking out the news that they're out of time for novels. You know, these theories make sense. Adults do spend hours trolling the internet. The war is definitely preoccupying. And young adult habits have changed. A generation ago, they read more books for fun than their parents. Today, they're busy instant messaging friends, checking email, downloading music, and blogging. We're all too plugged in to unplug and read a book. These days, the sight of novels makes me homesick. They were airplane tickets to Africa and Mississippi and the San Juan Islands. They were time machines and dream catchers. They once made me hurry home to find out what happened to the characters while I was gone. Now I surf the internet for breaking news for about a half hour each night, about the time once spent curled up with a good book. And on the nightstand sits Dandelion Wine, a book about the life of a boy when the days were long and warm and slow. The world Bradbury describes is 2 feet from my head. Lately, it might as well be 100 miles away.
Susan Nielsen is a columnist with the Oregonian newspaper. She lives in Portland, Oregon. Listeners, we want to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting your life? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.